accession number 18268, real one.
Bob Dare, real one. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Honiton, in Devon, in 1924.
So why is it that you speak like a Yorkshireman rather than a Dubai?
I've been here about 50 years now. I came here in 1943 and I went abroad on D-Day landings and I came back here and I've been here ever since. I got married here, you know, and stopped here.
And when you say here, you mean Hallamshire?
In Yorkshire, in Mosbury itself, you know, the little village here. I did my training here, you see, from 1943 to just before D-Day, 1944.
And we should say Mosbury's in the Sheffield area.
Yes, around here, yeah.
How and when did you come to be in the army, please?
I joined up in Exeter in 1942, August 1942. There were five of us. And we're of the age to volunteer. So I decided to join up with them.
Why did you decide to volunteer?
My father was a sergeant major in the Devonshire Regiment. And I thought, well, he volunteered in the First Asian War. And I thought, well, I'd better follow his example. And all five of us did, but two joined the Air Force. And three of us joined the Army, Coldstream Guards.
And had you been in any bombing of England by the German Air Force
before
that?
Oh, yes, in the Blitzkrieg at Exeter from 1940, you know, when they started bombing Exeter.
What do you remember about the bombing of Exeter?
Oh, and most of it, yes, it was terrific. Right up to the time when I joined the army in August 1942.
Tell me some specific details, please.
Well, it was just that you could see the incendiaries dropping all around on the hills around Exeter. And then after it lit everything up, then the bombers came up through the River Ex, low-flying, and they just bombed the village. We lived just on a fraction just outside of Exeter. And we could witness the bombing and whatever, till eventually we really got it all, you know, in the outskirts, the small villages outside, Countessware and Topsham. We really copped it all, you know, and it went on for ages. And my sister was a nurse. She did a lot of first aid work as well. But my father, actually myself as well, we were in the Home Guard. So we took part in a lot of the civil defence, which surrounded all that area at the time, you know.
What was your address when you were living near Exeter?
1 Hawthorne Road, Burnt House Lane, Exeter. It's near Countessware. It's just on the estuary. It's a wonderful place, wonderful little place.
And what particular buildings or streets do you remember being hit by the bombs?
Well, I remember mostly that the centre of the town, North Street, 4th Street, and the High Streets, and everything else, it was absolutely obliterated. Everything was, it was just literally wiped out. It was terrible, you know, it really, really blasted everything. It was one mass of flames being an old city. And there was a cathedral standing up in the middle, all on its own. Everything around it had been destroyed.
Were you in an air raid shelter when the bombing was occurring?
No, not always. Being in the Home Guard at the time, before I joined the army, we used to take part in the civil defence. Anything that else was needed, you see, we were called upon. And we did a lot of rescue work, you know, saving people from the rubble. In the estate, Burnt House Lane estate, we had a few sticks of bombs. And I managed to get one or two people out of the air raid shelters that was damaged and so on, in the houses. Because as a point, we used to have these little Morrison shelters in the house. They were steel. And we used to go in. And a lot of people survived with these little houses, you know, these little shelters and so on. But I did my best anyway at the time.
So it was just a question of clearing rubble with your hands?
Yes, mostly, you know, doing in general what we do. there was other duties to go and by, you know, helping traffic and ambulances and things like that, you know, anything really that you could be of use for, you know, at the time.
Did it surprise you that a cathedral town like Exeter should have been bombed? Yeah.
No, it should never have been bombed. It was one of the blitzkrieg towns, wasn't it? Coventry, or Norwich, Exeter, all those places.
How did public morale stand up to
that? Oh, it stood up very well down there. Very, very well. In Exeter itself, we had quite a few casualties, you know, but they didn't let themselves down in any way. They really, really backed each other up, you know, and did all sorts of things to help out.
What unit of the Home Guard did you belong to?
I can't exactly remember, but it was a mobile company. I've got some photographs of them, actually, in the Home Guard. And it was a mobile section, but I can't tell exactly which one it was. I may have a record somewhere of which unit it was, but I've definitely got some black and white photographs of us on exercises and things like that.
What do you mean by a mobile section?
Well, there were motorbike sidecars, different converted wagons, and anything that was mobile to get us about.
And where did you meet?
Ah, now we used to meet in, I think mostly it was pub yards, anywhere that we could get, you know, to meet together. I can't exactly tell you exactly where we met. It's hard to remember, you know, about those days. But we used to meet in church halls and whatever. But we used to do a lot of our training on the outskirts of Exeter as well. You know, in the fields and whatever, in the forest, in the woods, you know, to do the actual training with the regular, which held me in good stead when I joined the army. You see, they learned me to shoot, they learned me to camouflage, they learned me to do all sorts in the Home Guard, because the people that were training us were First World War veterans, you see.
But you mean you were meeting in the Countess Weir area, were you?
Yes, and the Exeter, yes, all around there.
What rank did you hold in the Home Guard?
I think an ordinary private. Because my father was a veteran and he became the Sergeant Major.
Did you have your own weapon?
Yes, we had rifles, machine guns, Lewis guns, things like that in those days.
Which year did you join the Home Guard?
I think it was 1941 when I was just older. I think I was one of the youngest to join. I think it'd be 16.
But your father was an NCO?
My father was a Sergeant Major, yes, I got a photograph of him as well. Because he was 16 when he joined up.
What units did you join when you joined the army itself?
The army itself? I just joined the Coldstream Guards.
After basic training?
No, I went straight into the Coldstream Guards at Caterham Barracks in Surrey, that isn't it, somewhere around there. I joined the Coldstream Guards from Exeter and they sent me to Caterham.
Was it your wish to be in the Coldstream Guards?
Oh yes, because it's, you see, down the south is what they call Monk's country, and General Monk is our, how can I describe it? Something to do with the guards itself, General Monk's army, you see, how they come to be Coldstreamers and things like that. It's a long story, which if you can get it from the archives, you know, tell all about it. But anybody down in Devon who wanted to join any unit of the army with prestige and things like that, it was the Coldstream Guards.
Which battalion did you go into?
First of all, when I went into the Guards, after I'd done my training, I went down to Pirbright and I joined the, what they call the Guards Armoured Training Wing, the GAT Wing. And that's where they trained me to do all the learning about lorries and different things like that, and then about tanks. And then when I finished there, I was qualified instructor and driver mechanic. They sent me from there to Rufford Abbey, which is near Nottingham. And we did training there, you know, with all the tanks and things like that. And that was in early 1943. And apart from the other duties that I did around London, you know, when I went from Purbright. And then I got posted from Purbright, Rufford Abbey, which is not far away from here, to Eckington, which is just down the road from here. And that's where I did my training right up until D-Day. So,
what unit did you go across to Europe on D-Day with?
With the 6th Guards Tank Brigade. 6th Independent Guards Tank Brigade.
And that was part of the Guards Army?
Yeah, it was. No, it was the 4th Battalion. The Guards Army Division were mostly Sherman tanks. And the 4th Battalion, which is made up of, you know, the infantry and different things, but had included with it the 6th Guards Tank Brigade, which were all Churchill tanks.
The 4th Battalion of the Coldstream
Guards? Yes, 4th Battalion, yes.
And what rank did you have in June 1944?
Guardsman, all the time. Just a driver, you know.
And when you went to Normandy, did you go on D-Day or after?
No, it was after D-Day. The exact date is very, very difficult for me to remember after the situation I was in. A lot of my old friends have got together to help me to remember a lot of the spaces that's in. But I think it maybe in June, July, just something like that. But it was earlier, when we first went over.
What kind of tanks did you take over?
Churchill tanks. And they were waterproof, these Churchill tanks. A lot of people don't remember about this, but we actually made them waterproof so that when they came off the landing craft, we went underwater. The louvers were extended up like snorkels. And we went underground, under the sea, and came out of the beach. And we fired a little fuse thing that released all the, it looked like barrage balloon stuff that was sealed all around. In actual fact, quite a few stalled their engines and drowned. And quite a few casualties like that. They never got out of the water. Never gone to the beach. So,
how far out were you when you went into the sea?
Oh, well, when I went in, it would maybe 10, 15 feet or something. It was, we didn't go right down in the water low enough so the water would go into the snorkel, into the tubes, you know, at the top. We just, underneath, most of the tank was underneath. I've got the tank that I can show you, you know. And we just dropped under there. I was underneath, the part of the turret was underneath, the engine was underneath, but the snorkels kept us going, you see. And then when we came up onto the beach, I'm afraid one or two people, the Germans and things, wondered what was happening because we fired this fuse and it exploded all the joints all around the turret to release the turret itself, you see.
Which beach did you land on?
Gold.
And was there any enemy fire when you landed?
No, not that when I got it. We went inland quite a bit before we met any resistance. And until eventually, when we did go in further inland, we were held back so often because we, on the right of us further down, was the Americans. They landed Omaha and Utah, and we were with those going towards Kern, you see, on the right. And even only about a few hundred yards away was Americans, and we were on this side. And we did a lot of their work for them because the Sherman tanks that they had were not capable, really, of climbing all the hills in the Bocage country, which was there. So they had to rely on the Churchill tank, and we did quite a lot of work. In fact, we went through and we have a hill there called called Coldstream Hill, and it's a pilgrimage by most Coldstream guys when they go into Normandy, and it's Hill 309.
Was that where you saw the heaviest action?
No, well, that, to start with, yes, when I got towards there. There were a lot in between, but not really, you know, not heavy. Plenty of shelling, but I mean, we didn't really think about it because we were inside.
What do you remember of the fighting at 309?
Well, a lot of it was 309. It was hills. It was a hill that we had to capture because the hills surrounding Caen itself, it was occupied by the German artillery and the infantry and all that, and they was bombarding Caen, and we couldn't move them off. And the Americans tried ages to get them off, and did everything to get them off. Anyway, we were asked, the 6th Attack Brigade, to come and take part. And I've got small letters, you know, saying that we'd made a little bit of history because we actually was able to go to the top and get them off without receiving any casualties because the American tanks, they would just hit them, call fire, and back they went. But we managed to get to the top. And it was a very important point, an observation point, to look over onto Caen, you see.
And you were telling me earlier about the name of your tank.
Jackal. J-A-C-K-A-L.
Jackal. Why was it called that?
Well, we all had names right through. They were, I've got a whole list. You get a Buffalo, Bandit, Buccaneer. And then you get, we had in our troop, Jacko, Rook, and there's some more. I've got them here recorded for them, if you like, for what they are, you see.
And who was in command of your tank?
Well, at the time, not at this time, that they move them about, you know, commanders, and you move your tanks about. Sometimes you can hang on to your tank for ages, but not always. But you replaced it. But when it was replaced, it kept the name, you see, each time. So in actual fact, it's like a broom. You can get new handles and new heads for it, you see. But it still maintained this name all the time, you see. So it was just one of those things.
So it's like a train called the Royal Scots.
Yes.
It might not be the same engine.
Not really, no. But that's how we managed to keep it, you know, because we lost a heck of a lot of tanks and men. So, but that went on for, well, quite some time, right around to August. It took us ages to get, just Caen didn't fall completely. It hung on for ages, and we were working our way around. It was a tactical move and a very sore point with Montgomery because the Americans said we should have gone faster, but we didn't want to do.
When you first went into action against the Germans in Normandy, what did you think of them as an enemy?
Well, it's very difficult now, you know, I mean, with hindsight, when you think about it, I just thought that was the enemy, and I just did my job. I just drove the tank. I was told where to go by a commander, up this hill, through the hedge. They fired the guns, I didn't. But a point which I think I must emphasise is that in a battlefield, there's a lot of German soldiers that get shot and wounded. Some are in hedge bottoms and whatever. We drive. But you do not know whether you're driving over them. You're just told to go straight. I mean, a battlefield, it can be actually covered with wounded soldiers and whoever they are, even our own. Unless the commander can see that they're our own, and they'll stop you. But apart from that, there was nothing about it. You just drove through the hedges over the top. There may have been some Germans on the side, wounded. We don't know. I would just do what I was told. And that's it.
What could you see when you were driving a tank?
A view about 6 inches by about 4 inches through the front or through the periscopes, which you can use. But we didn't use that very often because you needed both hands to drive the tank, you see.
Were the German soldiers in Normandy capable as soldiers or not?
Oh, yes. And they were very, very, very nasty, very nasty. There were quite a few of them. On one instance, we were bivouacked and in a small valley, and we had a lorry with provisions on and meals on and things like that. And everybody, and one, about four of them, sat on the tailboard of the lorry, and we were just speaking and chatting away and saying what things were like and writing any letters. And a shot rang out, and one of the men on the tailboard just fell off the back of the lorry shot. And he'd come out because, you see, it's a dense country, the Bagaj country, and he was shot. And he was shot by a Hitler youth that wasn't going to surrender. We'd already captured most of the area, but this is the mopping up that had to be done. But he was overlooked, and he was sat in a corner of a field, and three or four sniper rifles with him, you know, sized, everything else, grenades, everything else. And he fought to the end. He didn't give up. He was told in German by some people, you know, that spoke German, but he would never give in. And he just threw grenades in where he were, and he just got killed. But, I mean, it's the tenacity of some of these here young German soldiers there were really, really something to think about.
Where did that happen?
Well, that was in the Bagaj country. I mean, it was around the south of Caen, because the German troops were trying to retreat via Falle, which turned out to be the Falle Gap, which I wrote home about. It was one of the most terrible things I've ever seen in my life. I'd never seen anything like that. It was mayhem. Trucks, lorries burning, soldiers, animals. Oh, it was terrible. That was the Falle Gap.
Why was the appearance of the Falle Gap so terrible?
They were squashed by our landings in Normandy, going south. And the Americans going right down around Caen and coming up from the south. And they had a small funnel to go up through. And they all tried to get through, but they couldn't.
But was it just the sight of the dead that was so upsetting?
The numbers? Oh, yeah. I mean, it, you see, they were caught in this trap. And it was a terrible trap down there. They would never surrender. They just kept going. But they really got pounded, you know, and massacred troops, hundreds and hundreds of them. It's really, really bad.
How frightened were you in the fighting in Normandy?
Oh, yeah, frightened. There's no doubt about it. I mean, say they're not frightened. I mean, they're really liars, because you really, really get frightened, because you never know. I mean, all this, do these things. You could be caught in a mine. You could be, you know, shot by an end tank or another tank or whatever. But if you manage to get through all this without being hurt or fired on, then you consider yourself lucky. A lot were unlucky. A lot got hit. A lot went over mines. But it wasn't all just joyriding, you know, just like that.
How much did you see of the enemy tanks in Normandy?
Well, I didn't see a lot. You can't see a lot through the visors that we have, you know. Not when you stop after there's been a bit of a skirmish or whatever, and then you just get the, all right to look, sergeant, you open your hatch, stand up and have a look, you see. But that was it. And you could just look around and see what it is. And it was a good sight, but like I say, we were trained.
Did you consider the enemy armour superior or inferior to yours?
Well, no, superior, very superior in the fact that they had two tanks, and that was the Panther and the Tiger tank. And the Tiger tank was an awesome vehicle. We could never hit it properly. The shape made it so the shells burned off. And the gun that it had, the 88mm, it would go send a shell, an armour piercing shell, through 8 inches, 9 inches of steel, just as if you'd put a knife through butter. It was a terrible. Nobody, very seldom, survived any vehicle or any tank after it was hit by an 18mm from a Tiger tank.
How often did you come across those?
I didn't have. I'm alive to tell the tale. To tell the tale, but we've seen quite a few damage. When they ran out of fuel in the German army and they couldn't drive them anymore, what they used to do was to dig us a long trench in the ground. They used to bulldoze the tank into the ground so that the turret was just above the ground. Then they used to camouflage it. And it was suicidal because they could never survive after that. But they did get many. But they were always in a position where they put these tanks where our tanks would come through a hedge with the belly up before we flattened out. And they used to fire these shells into the bottom of the tank or the front. And possibly, you know, they got bombed by typhoons, you know, and destroyed. But it was a crude way. They had no fuel to drive the tank. And that's it.
Any other incidents that happened to you in Normandy?
Well, during the one bit of a comical one really in Normandy, and because as you know, if you're in a tank, sometimes you can be in for 24 to 36 hours and not get out. And everybody, as you know, would require a toilet, and we got permission sometimes to jump out and go into a hedge or whatever it is. And one of the tanks stopped, and the member of the crew wanted to use the toilet or something like that, so he let him go out and he jumped through the hedge. He got through the hedge and he dived back in and back into his tank, because the other side of the hedge was rows of infantry, German infantry, with all their guns. So what could he do? I mean, just get back into his tank. It was well, but the point is this, that even though the tanks didn't know, they sent some shots in to make them come out just to surrender. What we didn't know was that they were actually surrendered and they were prisoners of war and they were told to lay in the hedge because we were coming, you see. So we saved a lot of life, because if normally we would just rape the hedge with machine guns, turn the tanks around and done it, but we didn't. It's just one of the aspects about it. And he said, oh, what are they doing? He says, they're all laid down. Well, I mean, if the Germans is there, you know, they don't actually lay down behind a hedge when there's tanks coming. They try to use their things. But they were, the progress was that fast that we couldn't be bothered with them. We left it to the infantry and people to pick them up as prisoners, you see. Oh, it was comical to an extent, but it was frightening if you were an infantryman, you know.
That was at the time of the breakout from Normandy.
Yeah, that was yes, that was when we came just north of Garnat. As well, we had some of the 51st Highland Division men with us, and they were formidable fighters. They were really, because they'd heard about a German general that they never took any prisoners, and it is a fact actually that the men wouldn't shoot these. I think they were Scottish prisoners, you know. So he shot them himself, so they never took any prisoners. The 51st Hand never took any, because they shot their own comrades. And I think that is in the archives somewhere.